The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Studying medicine requires intelligence and discipline and considerable expense, making it a prestigious profession across America's religious and ethnic stratum. That wasn't always true. Bess Lovejoy wrote about one of the first major riots in the post-revolution United States, caused by popular anger against doctors. Her story of the so-called Doctors' Riot, which took place in New York City in April of 1788, is featured on Smithsonian.com. Bess, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Now, we hold doctors in such high esteem now, knowing they've been through so much schooling, that may be part of the reason. Not always the case. What did an aspiring physician in the late 18th century need to do in order to learn their practice?
Well, it really varied from place to place, but most of the licensing rules didn't come into place until pretty late in the century or in the early 20th century. And so a lot of the time, you would just do some private training with another physician, and often that was enough to allow you to go and hang out your shingle, particularly in a small town, and say you were a doctor. So the whole process of going to medical school and getting licensed and all of that wasn't really in place the way we think of it today in the era after the Revolutionary War. Things were just much too tumultuous.
But dissections were a pretty necessary part of the experience, from what I understand.
Yeah, certainly. Well, if you're going to be operating on somebody, you hope to have some training beforehand. And of course, today doctors are increasingly able to use digital means to practice dissection. They still dissect human beings, but there's a move towards doing it digitally and using even synthetic cadavers now. But back in the old days, really the only way to practice was on a cadaver. And so dissection was considered a pretty important part of medical training, particularly if you wanted to be, you know, good at what you were doing.
What was the attitude toward operating on cadavers at the time?
Pretty negative, pretty suspicious. I mean, this is one of the attitude changes that I think is really interesting. Until relatively recently, people thought of messing with the body after death as violating the sanctity of the dead bodies. There were also some Christians, and this varied, but there was a certain attitude towards this idea that if you were dissected after death, you might not be resurrected. And there was the other problem here is that because nobody was donating their body to science, the supply of cadavers was generally coming from graveyards. So often the legal supply of cadavers would just be a handful of executed criminals, and that was the case in both England and America. But there were far more doctors who wanted to practice on cadavers than there was supply of cadavers. So frequently, you know, the doctors and the medical students, and then sometimes also thieves that they would hire, would be going into the cemeteries and digging up bodies for dissection. Mm. And that was another thing that people really objected to.
And I read in your article that it was the African-American graveyards that were especially being disinterred in order to provide cadavers. And a group of African-Americans, both free and enslaved at the time, did petition the government about this. So tell us more about that phenomenon and their complaint.
Sure. Well, yeah, there was what was known at the time as the Negro's Burial Ground, which was established just outside of the city of New York City's city limits, right next to a pauper's graveyard. And the medical students would rob both of those graveyards for bodies. But what ended up happening is that the cadavers they were dissecting were disproportionately black. And I mean, that it was for the reason that you might imagine, which is just wholesale racism. Black bodies weren't given the same, they weren't thought of as being fully human in the same way that white bodies were. And so there was actually a petition. I can't remember the number of free and enslaved black people who lodged this petition with New York City City Council in, I believe it was February 1788, but they complained. And it's interesting because they actually didn't just complain about the dissection and then the robbery of the graves for the dissection, but they actually complained about how it was done. I think they said something about bodies being dragged away and wanton sallies of excess and entrails being spread around for animals. So they kind of said, you know, we understand that dissection needs to happen, but can you at least do it in a more orderly way? And the petition was entirely ignored. But what happened to kind of change things is that then there was a report of the body of a white woman being stolen from Trinity Churchyard a couple months after the petition from the blacks of New York. And that's when the popular resentment really started to boil over.
Yeah, tell us what happened. That seemed to have been the boiling point. That was in February of 1788, that the body of a white woman had been stolen. That really changed the game. And what happened?
Well, there's conflicting accounts of how the riot started. No one is exactly sure, but it seems that there were some small boys who were playing in the grass outside of New York Hospital, and that was one of the places where these kind of private lectures and dissections were taking place. And basically the boys saw something that really upset them. Either they climbed up and saw a body being dissected, or they saw sort of a withered arm being hung out the window to dry. And in one version of the story that gets repeated a lot of the time, one of the boys saw an arm being waved at the window by one of the medical students. And keep in mind, the medical students were probably boys who were only about 17 or 18, and so they're kind of messing with boys who are about 11 or 12. So one of these medical students is supposed to have said, "This is your mother's arm. I just dug it up." And the boy, you know, horrified, climbs down the ladder and runs to his father, who's a mason, working with a bunch of men on a building site sort of further down Broadway. And he tells his dad what happened, and his dad is concerned because, in fact, the boy's mother had just recently died. And so they go to the graveyard, exhume the coffin, and they do find the boy's mother's coffin empty. And so the father is very upset, and he gathers all of his other friends, all these other masons, and they're still carrying all their tools, their picks and their shovels and everything, and they march on New York Hospital and proceed to start tearing it apart. And that's pretty much how the riot starts.
Dun, dun, dun. I'm talking with Bess Lovejoy, who wrote about the gory New York City riot that shaped American medicine. That's the name of her article for Smithsonian.com. You feature some quotes in the article about the start of the riot, including one from Colonel William Heth. "The cry of barbarity was soon spread." So this started running amok all over town. It sounds pretty gruesome. What happened?
It was pretty gruesome, and like I said, there's conflicting accounts, but it sounds like when this mob of masons and other workers got to the hospital, they started taking out all of the pathological specimens, many of which had been imported from Europe. They'd start dragging them into the streets and setting them afire, and most of the medical students flee, although a couple of them try to stay to protect the specimens. They find some bodies that are being dissected in another room. They drag those to the bonfire also. And then what happens is, I think finally the mayor comes down and he escorts the remaining medical students off to jail for their own protection because he's worried that they're going to get dragged into the bonfire too. And the mob rages for a while and they burn things and destroy things. Things settle down overnight, but then in the morning, another mob goes and basically starts searching the entire city for cadavers in the midst of being dissected. So they search doctors' houses. They search Columbia. Alexander Hamilton is actually on the steps of Columbia trying to defend the school against the mob, and he actually gets kind of roughed up. I think he's knocked down, and he's not able to work for a couple of days because of it. And they don't find anything at Columbia, and in fact, they don't really find anything else in the city because as word of the mob has spread, the medical students and doctors have kind of carefully hidden anything that might be found. But the mob gets really upset. They go around the city, continue looking, and then finally they go to the jail where a couple of the medical students are being held, and they attack it. And then the militia comes out, and then more militia men come out, and people are fighting with bricks and bayonets and stones. And there's conflicting accounts of how many injuries and deaths there were, but somewhere between 3 and 20 people died. You know, and there's reports of blood staining the pavement and all of that. So it was pretty bloody, and it lasted for a few days until the militia was able to kind of settle things down.
Wow. Well, so what were some of the more immediate effects of the riots on doctors and their practices, both conventional and educational?
Well, the sort of the immediate effect is they stopped advertising. They pulled all of their ads from the papers, and then several doctors published announcements saying, we've never robbed any bodies from the city. And that's interesting because, as I was saying, the so-called Negro burial ground and the paupers burial ground were established outside the city. Essentially, these doctors are telling people, well, no, we've never robbed any respectable bodies. It's just, you know, these black bodies, you don't have to worry too much about that. But this is all sort of short-lived because pretty soon things start back up as they were before. And the following year, there's a law passed that tries to regulate the supply of cadavers and establish a legal supply, which was basically just getting them exclusively from executed criminals. But the law is kind of a joke. It doesn't supply as many cadavers are as necessary. And so the grave robbing continues, into the 19th century in some parts of the United States. But throughout the 19th century, there's a succession of these anatomy acts, sometimes called bone bills, that try to regulate this and create a legal supply of bodies for dissection so that medical students and doctors aren't robbing graveyards anymore.
Well, best love, Joy. Resurrecting a little bit of unknown history for us. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Best love, Joy, is author of Rest in Pieces, The Curious Fates of Famous Corpses. She's speaking with us today about her article for Smithsonian.com. It's called The Gory New York Riots That Shaped American Medicine. You can read the article yourself at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Word of Mouth listeners know that they can hear it online or by downloading our Word of Mouth podcast. But we also have another podcast we're calling the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop. That's where we go behind the scenes with renowned authors to find out what really goes into their work. In this episode, we talk with Tom Gelton. He's a longtime NPR reporter and five-time author. His most recent book is called A Nation of Nations. We were so fortunate that Tom Gelton was visiting New Hampshire and was able to join us in the studio to talk about his creative process.
This is Tom Gelton with the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop.
Oh, you are one of those voices. It's so fun to see you speak. We know your voice so well. So, Tom, you've written a couple of books now. Which is harder for you to write, the first sentence or the last?
The first sentence is harder to write. I actually think the last sentence is the more important one. And that, in a way, comes, I think, from my radio experience, because in radio, you know, radio journalism is storytelling. You're telling a story to people. And when you tell stories to people, the last line is so conclusive, so important, you really wind it up. When you learn to be a journalist in print, the last sentence can be cut. You know, when you cut a story, you cut from the bottom. So the last sentence isn't important. In radio, it's really important. And for me as a writer, the last sentence is the most important. But you're right. I mean, the first sentence, when you're just trying to figure out how to start this book, and you know that a lot of people are going to read the first sentence and decide whether to read any more or not, the first sentence is really important. But I think in terms of the story that I'm going to tell, it's the last sentence that's the most important.
Now, you're used to being a broadcast journalist, so you're used to working on deadline.
Right.
So different than the experience of a lot of writers who are on deadlines, but they're not as tight. What's your personal worst distraction from getting your work done?
The worst distraction is frustration. When I feel like it's not very good, when I've spent a lot of time, you know, on a single paragraph and I throw it out and I start getting upset with myself, I start getting discouraged. You know, and then I look for opportunities to distract myself. Oh, I think I need to, you know, I need to get up and get some exercise. I need to go to the gym. I need to work out. I need to do some work around the house, you know, and it's sort of that combination of looking for an excuse and feeling bad about what you're doing. When I'm writing well, the time just flies.
Otherwise, you floss your teeth a lot. That's what I hear.
No, that's not what I would do. I wouldn't floss my teeth. No, I'd prefer to go do something really physical, actually, where I can really change my mind.
Do you edit as you're going along or all at once at the end?
No, I do both. I edit as I go along. I have a process, a really kind of organic process. When I'm starting a new section, when I'm writing something completely fresh, I always do it longhand. I find that I can sort of think more creatively longhand. And I actually can write more quickly longhand than I can type. There's a danger to that, which is my handwriting's not very good. And sometimes, you know, it's coming out really fast and I'm scrawling it. And then after writing about three pages, I think, okay, now I got to go type it. And then, shoot, what was I saying? And I'm like trying to figure out what that word was. And it sounded so good when I was writing it. And now I've like got this scrawl in front of me and I'm trying to figure out what it was that I was saying. But in spite of that, it's really, I feel like there's something more organic, something more creative about writing longhand. It's sort of like straight from your mind through your hand to the paper, you know, and without any machines in between. So the first, whenever I'm doing something fresh, I always do it longhand.
Do you write with pen or pencil?
I write with pen on a legal pad.
Ah.
Actually, I look for these particular kind of legal. I had to go on the internet and find it because what I like is a spiral bound legal pad with very hard covers so that it kind of provides backing. And I used to be able to get them at CVS all the time. I just go into CVS and buy a dozen of them or something. And then all of a sudden, they stopped selling them. So I was desperate to find them. And I went on the internet and I found somebody that sold them. And I ordered a whole case of them.
So that's the best thing to write on. How about environmentally? Do you have to be in a certain place? I mean, you're on the road a lot, aren't you?
I'm on the road a lot, but I don't write on the road. You know, when I've written these books, I've taken time off from my reporting. I've taken a leave of absence. And when I wrote my Bacardi in Cuba book, I did it upstairs in a spare bedroom. And it took me a long time. I was working on that book off and on for about 3 or 4 years. And my wife got really fed up. She did not like me being sort of up there. She'd have a day off, and she'd like to come home and play music or do whatever she wanted to do. And, like, I'd be up there clicking away, and it drove her crazy. So when I set out writing this last book, she said, "You're not writing that book at home. You're going to have to find somewhere else to write it." So I went, and I found a really great little room in an office building about 5 miles away. It had a coffee shop in the basement. It had a gym about a block away. It had free parking. It was the ideal place. And I would get up and I'd go there and that would force me to write because, you know, there are fewer distractions when you're in an office than when you're at home in a bedroom. So I found that great. I think I was much more productive there. And I've actually kept it with the idea that there's going to be another book coming along and I've got the perfect little writing space for it now. And so I'm paying the rent on it. I'm keeping it alive. I've got my bookshelves there. I've got it all set up. Nobody else knows about it. Nobody else visits me there. It's my own private little space. And I can go there whenever it's time to do some other big writing project. I got the place where I can go.
Mm. Are there any personal habits that you would encourage writers to take up, aspiring writers, or to avoid even, to be more productive?
I think the most important thing is discipline. I think that, you know, a lot of writers that I know get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and write. And I really respect that because that imposes a sense of discipline on you and you can't achieve anything without discipline. I can't do that. I'm not a morning person. It's much easier for me to write, you know, deep into the night and just stay writing until I've just physically can't do anymore, until the thoughts stop coming. But whether it's staying up late at night or getting up early in the morning, discipline, I think, is really, really important because there are many times when you can just sort of quit and you just can't do that. It takes a lot of work to write a book, to write anything. But when you're talking about, you know, 150 or 200,000 words, they're going to get cut down. But that's a big undertaking. And you have to go at it day after day after day. You have to just get up and do it.
What do you think is the most common mistake that new writers make? And maybe it's one that you made yourself.
You know, everybody's going to answer that question differently. I think it's a stylistic thing. I think that people get really self-conscious about their writing and sort of deliberately use words that are too big, phrases that are too long. You know, strip it down to the bare essentials. I read The Elements of Style over and over again. I mean, You know, and this is something that I think I learned from my radio writing. When you write for broadcast, you learn to write simple declarative sentences. You stay away from adjectives. You stay away from adverbs. You stay away from introductory clauses. You write clear sentences with strong verbs, you know, that don't go on forever. And I think if you're self-conscious about your writing, you sort of think it's somehow better to have like florid phrasing and fancy words and metaphors. I don't even like metaphors. I just like really clean, simple writing that is as clear as a bell.
That's great advice. And I'm wondering what the best advice you ever received about writing was.
Oof. I would say that that's it. I mean, I didn't begin as a writer. I began as a radio journalist. And I was fortunate in getting really good guidance as a beginning journalist. I had an editor who once said the most important thing in radio journalism is reading and writing. And reading and writing, I learned to read what I was writing out loud. That's important for radio, but you know what? I have found it's also important for book writing or for story writing. You know, because people hear what you read. They sometimes have stories read to them. I just find that if I read what I write out loud, whether it's a radio script or a nonfiction novel, it just helps, because then I know, you know, if I'm getting a little too self-important in my prose, if it's getting a little too convoluted, a little too fancy, I'm going to hear that before I see it.
Tom Delton joining us there for our spinoff podcast, The 10-Minute Writer's Workshop. If you'd like to hear more episodes, subscribe to the podcast. You'll find the link on our website, wordofmouthradio.org, or on iTunes at The 10-Minute Writer's Workshop.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Here in the U.S., St. Patrick's Day is all about parades and shamrocks and green beer and kiss me, I'm Irish buttons. But how do the real Irish celebrate the holiday? Maeve Conran brings us this story from Dublin.
Hail, glorious St. Patrick, dear Saint of our Isle.
St. Patrick's Day, March 17th. One of the few holidays specific to a country, but now celebrated internationally. Although the image of green beer and even rivers dyed green is particular to the American experience of the day, parades and celebrations are held as far away as Russia and Korea. Even in Ireland, it's become a global affair.
We're still counting, but certainly there's over the whole festival, I would say probably in the region of 15 different countries are represented.
Donal Shields, the CEO of the Irish St. Patrick's Festival.
We actually start off the festival on Wednesday the 16th of March, and it runs until Sunday the 20th of March. And it goes to diverse events like the Luminarium, but also on the same day we have the International
Spanning Symposium 5 days, the St. Patrick's Day celebrations in Ireland are a huge event, a whole lot different from when I was growing up. 20 years ago, it was all about wearing your best green dress to Mass, with a huge bunch of shamrocks pinned to your lapel. The highlight of the day, of course, was the parade. Not a sophisticated affair like today. Just a few floats, some marching bands, and of course, the Irish dancers. But it was magical. It was our chance to show some national pride in our national holiday, St. Patrick's Day, Lough Lefaile Pórig. It's still a celebration of our national identity, what it means to be Irish. But ironically enough, Patrick himself wasn't even born there. Father Vincent O'Hara explains.
Of course, he's one of the great figures of Irish history. He wasn't born in Ireland at all. In fact, we're not sure where he was born, possibly around Wales or England. And the first time he came as a slave.
After his humble beginnings as a shepherd in slavery, Patrick escaped and fled the country that had held him captive for 2 years, but somehow ended up as its patron saint.
He said himself that he heard voices calling him from the western shores of Ireland, "Come, youth, and walk once more amongst us." So he was eventually sent then in the year 432 by Pope Celestine to Christianize Ireland, which was largely what we would call pagan up to then. The kind of religion would be a kind of a druidism. And in fact, he challenged the king at the time the king was lighting his fire, his paschal fire, so to speak, on the hill of Tara. And Patrick lit his own paschal Easter fire on the opposite mountain or hill. And the chiefs of the king said, unless you put out that fire of this man Patrick, that light will never be extinguished. So it was a kind of a prophetic statement. And thank God the faith which Patrick brought to Ireland is still with us. Maybe not as strong, but it hasn't gone out. And there is the hymn which we sometimes sing, Faith of Our Fathers Living Still in Spite of Dungeon, Fire and Sword.
So, in fact, St. Patrick's Day is a religious holiday. But for those not quite so spiritually minded, what's on offer?
Paddy's Day is just a right bit of crack all day.
Not illicit drugs, of course. Crack is the Irish word for fun. Vivian Walsh is the head barman in one of Dublin's oldest pubs.
It's a big booze up. It's a big session, St. Patrick's Day. Everybody tends to take a couple of days off either side of it. And come out in the early afternoon and don't go home until well into the next morning.
The 200-year-old Kyo's pub in the city centre sells more than 4,000 pints of Guinness on an average St. Patrick's Day alone.
On a particular St. Patrick's Day, you could be looking at getting rid of 40 kegs of Guinness, maybe. Potentially is one of our biggest days of the whole year. That taking out Christmas week, St. Patrick's Day is our busiest day.
Drinking Guinness in a traditional pub is as much a part of the national celebration is going to Mass and watching the parade. But being Irish nowadays is a different concept from that of 20 years ago. Unlike years gone by, when thousands emigrated every year, today, thousands of immigrants come to Ireland looking for work. With the new cultures and traditions that these people bring, a booming economy and a more secularised society, Father Vincent explains, there's still room to celebrate our Catholic origins.
Well, it would still be a nominally Catholic country, and I suppose as countries go, attendance at Mass would still be very high, maybe 60% that would still go at the weekends. But I think the ethos is changing, all right, the kind of Christian ethos of the country and what we call the Celtic Tiger and the newfound wealth that we have in recent decades. I suppose that has made inroads into the spirituality and the faith of the people as well.
So with more than a million people, including 250,000 tourists, set to descend on Dublin for this weekend celebrations, there's just that one other traditional Irish element to think about. After all, it's what makes the country so green. So, will it rain on the parade? Donal Shields, festival organiser.
Oh yeah, I'm under pressure big time because we've had really good weather for the last 3 years. So I'm just hoping we get it all out of the way and global warming takes its full effect.
From Dublin, this is Maeve Conran.
And St. Patrick's Day would not be complete without some Irish music. Last year, we compiled an essential St. Patrick's Day playlist based on listeners' suggestions, filled with reels, drinking songs, and the old heart-tugging, sappy numbers. Here are just a few.
Whack for the daddy-o, there's whiskey in the jar.
Oh, Johnny boy, the pipes are calling. From glen to glen and down the mountainside.
The summer's gone and all the flowers are full. Tis you,
And we'll all go together to pluck wild mountain thyme all around the blooming heather. Will ya go, lassie, go?
And it's now,
we invite you to add to the list this year. Which songs do you have on repeat every March 17th? Add your suggestions to our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. Because sharing favorite songs, ideas, and suggestions is what makes public radio public. We bring you stories and interviews that inspire and delight, and we hope you'll share them with your friends and your family. We can't make word of mouth without your support. So now is a great time to show your appreciation for everything that New Hampshire Public Radio brings to you. It's our March Fund Drive. Please give as generously as you can to keep the shows you love, like Word of Mouth, on the air and available to everybody.